Is it true that the people that made AI don't know how it works?
A little bit.
That is very Black Mirror.
So for the second year running, Manchester's got the most AI businesses in the UK. But if your business doesn't need it right now, don't implement it.
I think there's a ballsiness about...
Mancunians.
The thought that at 35 miles from the sea, we would decide, Liverpool, I see you with your port, but we're going to build our own. And don't worry, we're just going to build this whole ship canal that bypasses you. It's such a Manchester thing to do. Like, we did the same thing with cyber. If you speak to anyone that was involved in that, they will admit that they were shaky reasons at best.
Right, so hello and welcome. My name is Tanya Grady, and you're listening to the very first edition of Foundations, recorded live at Campfield in central Manchester, a next generation campus for technology and creative industries. Foundations is a celebration of bold beginnings, brave ideas, and people who make them possible. And in this episode, we'll be discussing the infrastructure of creation, designing the systems that power innovation. So we often celebrate that spark of kind of creativity, the lightning bolt, eureka kind of moment. But today we're shifting the spotlight to the structures behind the spark. What makes creativity not just possible, but sustainable? And what systems, their physical, technological, social, actually support people to bring their ideas to life? So joining me are four incredible panelists who don't just create, they design the conditions for others to create. So next to me, I've got the incredible Liz Scott, MBE. Woo! Liz is Chief Executive Director of the Turing Innovation Catalyst, also known as TIC. TIC is a not-for-profit initiative based at the University of Manchester. TIC's mission is to catalyse and accelerate AI and deep tech innovation across Greater Manchester region. Liz is here to talk about the role of emerging tech, especially AI, which is the hottest topic in town.
So hot.
So in unlocking new creative potential and the responsibility that comes with it. Then we've got Joe Reiser, founder and producer at Fuzzy Elephant Studio, which is based over at the Bonded Warehouse. Joe is a sonic architect. Have you been called that before, Joe? There you go. Shaping not just sound, but the entire emotional and practical environment in which musicians create. Joe is here to talk about how the rituals of music production can shape focus, clarity, and emotional resonance in creative work. We've got Grace Cooper next to Joe. Grace is design director at Heart, a studio known for shaping spaces that blend hospitality, co-working, and culture. Grace brings insight into how physical environments like studios, workspaces, even lighting and layout can either inspire or frustrate our creative process. Heart are also responsible for this incredible campus. This is like a total feat of design work, so you should be very proud, Grace. Well done. Incredible work. And then Rich Jones, last but not least. Rich Jones is Leeds Exchange, one of Manchester's flagship tech accelerators based here at Campfield in St. John's. Rich will be talking to us about invisible infrastructures, from funding models to mentorship frameworks, and support early stage innovators, frameworks that support early stage innovators. So whether you're a designer, a founder, a technologist, or just someone trying to get their next idea off the ground, this conversation is about the systems that hold you up or hold you back. Great. So to get us started, Joe, for people outside the music world, this is quite a basic question, actually, so just prepare yourself for this.
Sure.
The role of a producer can seem a bit of a mystery. I know it is to me. So the kind of like those not in the music industry. So what does a music producer actually do?
So the honest answer is it is a bit of a mystery because it can be so many different things. So it can really be anything from the person that tells you when to take lunch and works out when the work is done, all the way through to someone that's writing the music, producing the music, recording the music, mixing the music, doing everything. So it covers a massive range of kind of different roles. But the key thing is it's the person that's probably external to the artist themselves that takes a creative product from inception to finalized product. So whether that be music. So it'll be, you know, musical ideas and then all the way through to releasing an album or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Thanks, Joe. So Grace, what is one spatial design choice you've seen consistently enhance creativity across disciplines?
Well, I think it's something that Scott's already kind of touched on, but it is the huge variety now of spaces within a single office. It's no longer traditionally open plan versus private office meeting room space. It's absolutely everything in between. You need breakout for 20 people. You need phone booths for private calls. You need sort of a million different spaces that people can work for different tasks as well. And so that sort of working increases creativity because it increases movement around the office. You sit down and talk to people you might not necessarily be on a team with, and that sort of collaboration and creativity and spontaneity is really what we're designing for now.
I mean, this is the best showcase ever for like a collaborative type of environment and space, Grace. This is like unreal. It's really unusual that you walk into a building, you interact with the entire space as well. Did you find that easier or harder when it came to kind of designing around like collaboration?
I'd say this is quite an easy one, really, because there is so much space to fill here. So we've got opportunities to tuck things in a little corner and sort of we receive a brief of what we want to provide in terms of offices. But there's a lot of opportunity here for introducing those. It's a real showcase.
It's amazing. Well done, Grace. Rich.
Hi.
Hello. So from your experience, what's one piece of infrastructure, be it funding, mentoring, policy, that's often missing for early stage creators?
I think, especially for early stage creators, you wake up that morning with your idea, you know, wanting to start this business, but you're not quite sure the support that's on offer. So I think one thing that's missing, I mean, there's lots of great programs, especially within Manchester, lots of early stage programs. But you've got quite a lot out there that are multi-sector, so not sector specific. So if you're a creative person, and yeah, I guess if you don't have that tribe with you, it can be quite hard to make connections and collaborate. But also mentorship as well. Once you leave a program, it almost feels like that's the end. But for that early stage founder. And I think having those mentors that are available after when programs finish definitely would help with that early stage to make it, I guess, their journey not just end there. They can continuously check in with someone.
Absolutely. And Liz, you've got a lot of experience in this space as well, haven't you? Liz actually used to run Tech Nation and supported us with our exchange in its first kind of inception. So this is like a nice serendipitous moment for us. Liz is now working in AI, as we kind of touched on before, and leading on tech. So AI is literally the hottest topic in town, isn't it? Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's scared of it. So how do you define co-creation, would you say, when working with AI, Liz, and what does that look like in practice?
Oh, that's a big question. So I think it depends the type of organisation that you're talking about, because we look after a bunch of different innovators and entrepreneurs and different types of businesses at Tick. Some of them are building AI-first products and companies. So if you took the AI away, there'd be nothing left. You know, it is the core of what they're building. And in those instances, you know, the co-creation is often just very open from an AI perspective. You know, they will have developers and software engineers in their team. They're all very comfortable with the art of the possible, and it's just in kind of the fabric of the organization. We also do some work with organizations that are not AI first, and they might have a layer of AI in a product or a service that they use, but it's not the core of their product. And that, I think, is where you get a lot more of the fear that you talk about and a lot more of the kind of confusion. You know, we've seen in the companies that are on some of our cohorts really feeling like they've been left behind, you know, knowing that they should be doing something with AI, but they don't know what that is. So we've spent some time with creatives and other business leaders just having them understand. So first of all, what is it and what is it not? Because there's so much noise and nonsense in the system. But then also, if you were going to systematically look at your business, whether that is based around a creative process or a creative product, where would the opportunities be for innovation? And which of those should you prioritise, and how do you get started on them? So I think for us, it's always about the really practical, like, how do you go from an idea or a vague feeling that you should be doing something to really practical experimentation and then kind of implementing it across the business?
Can I jump in on that as well?
Yeah.
So something I read recently, so for the second year running, Manchester's got the most AI businesses in the UK. Mm-hmm. So there definitely needs to be that support. And you're right, Liz, you know, even on exchange, we see businesses that are ticking the AI box, and they feel like they have to be doing something that's AI enabled. But, you know, I know it's going to be the next big thing, especially like within Manchester with all the AI businesses that we've got. But if your business doesn't need it right now, don't implement it. That's what I would say.
Yeah, and it can be a real double-edged sword, that, because we've certainly seen that amongst all the hype, there are a lot of investors that will say that their investment thesis is hinged on AI, and therefore they're the sort of businesses that they want to see. And then you do get startups that are perhaps not really AI, kind of ticking that box because they think it gets them into rooms. But you've got to be really careful about that, because the investor that you're going to be sat across from is going to have a certain level of expectation. And it's not about it being a value judgment on your business. You can have a really solid business that hasn't got AI at the core of it. But let's just be really honest about how it's used, what it's for, and whether it's of benefit to you, and whether that's now or in 6 months or 12 months. Like, let's just be really practical about it.
Is it true that the people that made AI don't know how it works? This is what I've heard. Is this just like...
A little bit.
That is very Black Mirror.
There are... So, I mean, I could bore you for days, but I'm not going to do, because the programme is too busy today. But there are a lot of different concepts. There's a bit of a movement around this kind of concept of human in the loop. So how do you design an AI system so that deliberately it has to include human oversight and human intervention at the various different stages? That doesn't sound controversial or like it should be rocket science, but there are systems that are designed without that. You have to deliberately design to make sure that that is a feature. And you don't want to think about that too much, because there are some systems that haven't got so much of that.
And apparently it hallucinates as well. This is what I've heard. AI can hallucinate. Have you heard this?
It absolutely can hallucinate. You have to check your sources when you're asking your GPT to do any research for you.
Oh, no, because that's everyone's new best friend, isn't it? ChatGPT, let's be honest. She's my new best mate. So, Joe, back to you. The Fuzzy Elephant Studio is an amazing space. If those haven't seen it, get down, have a look. It's at the Bonded Warehouse building, not from here, in the St. John's Estate. I know you designed and built it yourself with your bare hands, did incredibly well. What makes a studio more than just a room with equipment? What makes it, say, a creative platform or engine?
I think studio engineers and producers, we kind of exist in this strange world where it's art and it's creativity, but we also have to be technicians. And, you know, those two things don't always go hand in hand. And often they're kind of, they've got kind of, you know, they fight each other, you know. So a large part of what a studio does is to try and make the technical and easy and kind of easy and simple things to do so that it doesn't get in the way of creativity. And so that's the big thing, really. And that's kind of been the focus of building our studio, is trying to make it so that collaboration and creativity are the focus and that tech doesn't get in the way. So we designed, kind of modelled our studio on the studio that I've recorded in a few times, called Real World, which is it's Peter Gabriel's studio. It's this incredible space. But unusually, compared to other studios, everything's all in one room. So, you know, the most recording studios, you have a control room, you have a live room, you have separate spaces all kind of separated from each other, you know, with glass, so you can still see each other and still work together. But there is a physical separation between you and the artist. And often, you know, you're communicating through headphones and talk back, and you end up with these situations where, you know, you can be having a conversation maybe with another artist in the control room, and there's another member of the band or another new musician sitting in the live room, just sitting there kind of waiting to, you know, be like, come on, what's happening? Can I be part of this conversation? Can I be involved? So working in a Real World kind of really, I know, it was a really, it just felt like it was such more of a creative process, that everyone's all in the same space, everyone can communicate easily. Also, all the creative tools are just at your disposal, you know, two hand. So yeah, that was kind of what we modelled building our space on, so just a much smaller version of the same thing. And in addition to that, you know, a lot of recording studios, you know, have closed over the last kind of, you know, 20 years because the advent of, you know, digital technology has really, in many ways, it's really democratized recording music, which has been incredible. We have people in bedrooms writing platinum records, which is amazing. You know, major labels and budgets no longer have to dictate, you know, creating music and getting it out to the world. But one disadvantage of kind of everything being so computer-based is that even though computers are pretty incredible these days, they're not very good tools for collaboration in one room. You know, a computer has one driver, it has one person that operates it. So having something that's not directly computer-based for working with multiple people in the same space, I think is really important. So for us, basing our studio around kind of a large format analog console, so a big mixing desk, lots of equipment that's, you know, tactile, you can touch and use, things that are on shelves that you can get out and kind of play with. And so it becomes like the actual use of the space becomes a creative endeavor rather than just, you know, rather than just a place to be in. Yeah.
Thanks, Joe. And AI has not bulldozed its way in, just yet, has it?
Not yet. I mean, it's interesting, really. I mean, there's a lot of fear in the music industry about AI, obviously because it's, you know, so much of the music industry is creators and people are worried that, you know, it's going to take over from, you know, take over and take away from people that are creating. But I haven't personally seen it yet, but I'm sure there are going to be some really interesting kind of ways that AI helps creation. But it's I think that at the moment, that hasn't been the focus of the companies that are generating AI tools. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I haven't seen them yet. Is that anything you've seen so far?
I think it's been really interesting for us to see how people that are operating already in a sector are spotting an opportunity for AI to do something that they just could never scale to do. I can't see Sam, but I'm gonna call out Reform for doing some amazing work with Beep AI. So a solution that can automatically censor harmful content in a radio environment, like one, who doesn't want that? But two, that's a lot of person hours if you're going to do that individually. So, you know, that's not taken from the creative process, but it's a really important part of that whole universe that needs solving, and actually AI can do that really well. We've seen it again with the way that companies like GigPig can connect artists to live music venues in a way that has never really been done at scale before. So not taking away from the creative process, but making the business of that creative process more accessible, smoother, available at scale. So we've seen a lot of that rather than putting creators out of business.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's what people need to be looking for, is things to speed up what they're doing already, rather than things that are kind of, I think, like, you know, like you mentioned before, there's a lot of fear mongering around AI in general and the fear that it's going to take away, but maybe the focus needs to be more of what it can enable us to do.
And also, what have you hated doing? Yeah. We talk to our businesses about this a lot. Like, I don't think a single person in any type of business would put their hand up and say, there is no drudgery in my job or my team's job. There are all manner of repetitive, horrible things that humans do not enjoy doing. Let's get rid of that first.
And it's just a mindset, really, isn't it, AI? Like, you just got to change that mindset. If you see it as helping you with productivity and not it's going to steal your job, then it's there to help you. And like you say there, Liz, you know, how many hours can you save doing those endless tasks that no one wants to do, where it could be sped up in minutes? So it's definitely a mindset from my point of view.
Yeah, an opportunity. Also, if you want to swear on this panel, swear away, because we will be using Beep AI. Got your back. Product placement. So, Rich, the exchange program supports founders, not just with space, but with mentoring, community, and visibility. What part of the program do founders consistently find most transformative, and has anything surprised you about what they actually value most?
Yes. So my background is I came from a competitor. I won't say the name, but they're a multi-sector accelerator. But the fact that we are exchange sector specific, the fact that everyone's in the same boat, they're all, you know, they've got to have like an MVP or product or service ready to go. So we're not an incubator, they're not at idea stage, they're all on that same journey. The fact that they can come in at least once a week to collaborate, they find super beneficial. But the one thing that I actually brought over from my previous role was group coaching. That's the one thing that really, really surprised me that worked well here. over at Exchange. So once a month, we get them all to come together into groups of three or four. We use like a really easy coaching technique called the Grow Model. And they're expected to come to that session with a challenge. And it's just peer-to-peer support. You know, being in the same room with those founders that are at the same level as you, probably going through the same challenges. And it can be quite lonely being an entrepreneur, right? Especially a solopreneur. You know, you're probably, your friends and family probably don't get what you're doing. They probably just think you're, you know, going away in a coffee shop, swanning around into nice, lovely buildings once a week, you know, at least. When really it is quite lonely. And I think just having that peer-to-peer support where they can come together, discuss the challenges, set some accountability with each other. I think for me, that's one of the biggest highlights that I've seen in the 18 months while I've been at Exchange.
Thank you. And I'm going to reframe this question slightly, Liz, because we've kind of already touched on it already. I know that we said don't force AI into your business if there's not a need or a want, but do you not risk being left behind if you don't introduce it?
I think there is a bit of false urgency where everybody thinks everybody else is like busy building their own large language models and going to town. That's not true. So get rid of the false urgency, I guess, would be my first thing. And then I think you have to think about this in the same way that you think about any kind of iteration of the business or of the product. What are your customers? So if it's thinking about the company and productivity, that is the people that work in your company. If it's actual customers, what do they need? How are you going to get there? What's stopping you? What has been a stubborn blocker? And yes, think about whether AI or other technologies might help, but start from the customer need. Don't start from, I've got an investor that's jumping up and down saying I should be adopting AI, but I don't know what to be doing. I don't know where to put it. And I don't know how to do it safely. Like it can't be technology driven. It has to be customer need driven. And we have to remind people of that all the time.
I can imagine. I can well imagine. So, Joe, you're essentially working with artists to refine their ideas. How do you apply or even encourage innovation to achieve this?
So, a lot of what we do in a music studio, in the creative side of things, not the kind of technical side, is really trying to keep creative flow going. And part of that is things I spoke about before, which is, you know, getting the tech out of there, you know, so that you're not having to wait for tech, you're not having to set it up, you're not having to be, oh, sorry, if you want to do that, we have to sort this out. So, you know, first of all, keep creative flow going, encourage the environment that makes, you know, makes creative flow a natural thing to happen. And then the other thing, obviously, is like creative flow isn't just a limitless thing that continues. So the other thing is to find strategies that can help you kind of get past roadblocks. One of the things that I really like that's really useful is there's a deck of cards that Brian Eno designed called Oblique Strategies, which is just, you know, they're really lovely ways of kind of just helping you to laterally think around a problem or around a process. They're kind of similar to, you know, some people use the I Ching for you know, it's a similar idea, but it's just a, you know, recognizing when you've found a creative blockage and then just being able to step back from it and then go, okay, how can we think of this in a different way? How can we kind of navigate around it and then get back into that kind of flow state of creativity? That's kind of one of the things we really try and, yeah, aim to keep going. Yeah.
It's interesting that you can apply that to any discipline industry, can't you, really, when it comes to kind of creativity and not blocking that, the amount of people that you hear getting writer's block. And it's interesting how spaces can really help kind of encourage that, or they actually do kind of like properly block that. And this is why this type of space, I think, it's really inspiring to be in a collaborative environment with loads of other people working in a similar industry. You leave the space feeling inspired. You come to the space, you feel inspired. You've got all the natural light and vitamin D, and it does make a massive difference to your kind of creative process. So, Grace, how then do you balance aesthetics and functionality when designing a space specifically for creative work?
So I think, as if you were designing for any type of work, creative or not, it always starts with the operational brief. And we are so fortunate to work really closely with our operational team throughout the design process. So we get very reactive feedback from the tenants of other buildings. And so that can really inform where we're going and help us to get to the layout plans really quickly. And once we've got that fixed and decided, that's when the fun begins. And that's why there's when there is endless possibilities and we layer on materiality and colour and furniture and planting, and we can really start to play with them. This building is just a open palette for that type of thing. And there's sort of a lot of games that we played. So for example, all of the, you'll notice quite a lot of bright colours here. We've really tried to make sure there's a very visible difference between the old and the new. So for example, the user journey is highlighted via a series of very bright coloured doors, whereas you will not read any of the back of house functional doors, which are all fully integrated around the space because that's where the rooms were to start with. But being monochrome, you just don't read them on the user journey. So we can use that sort of trick to guide people around. And then as well as that, there's also the insertion of items or areas that sort of harbour creativity and allow for self-expression, such as these sort of external garden areas that we've got to the ground floor suites that people can personalise and make their own, and the mesh screening, which we're hoping people will use as sort of large-scale clipboards with bulldog clips to sort of show what they're working on and sort of, brainstorm publicly. So there's lots of opportunity in this space, and it's been great fun.
Amazing. The psychology of the user, you don't think it's like really interesting, isn't it? You don't even realise how you interact with the space.
Can I ask you a question, Grace?
Absolutely.
It was literally going through my head then as you were talking. You know, when you walk into an empty shell, like this was when, before we moved in, what is your first thought? Like, what is that first thought when you look at the space?
Well, it's not normally just me who walks in. There's a whole barrage of team of us, 14 opinions coming at you at once. But often we're sort of striding out and imagining, and we have our hands up here. Everyone's sort of describing different ideas, and we're marking out, oh, perhaps this will come to here and that to there. But sort of my job is taking that back home to the drawing and starting to plot things out so we can start to sort of envisage and see it come to life.
That's an interesting kind of thing to touch on as well, Grace, because you've got so many cooks and it's so hard to please everyone and to tick every box, isn't it? And to ensure that you're able to design something that is super functional but so incredibly design-led, like these spaces. And famously, all your kind of portfolio is massively design-led. So it's an amazing kind of space to be in and to enjoy. So thank you. We're going to look forward to living here, aren't we? Hopefully a lot of us will be moving in. Are you moving in this?
Try and get me out.
Yeah, that's it. So, Rich, how do you ensure that the frameworks you design remain flexible enough to support diverse forms of innovation?
I think you've got to continuously learn and improve. So what might work now in 12 to 18 months might not work, especially AI, you know, like it is the hot topic at the moment. One thing we do over at Exchanges is ask for regular feedback. So we'll do a feedback survey month 2 and month 6, ask what's been working well, what hasn't been working well, and we adapt the next cohort for that. There's no point coming in and going, okay, yeah, this is the way that it should be done, but if it's not working, you're not going to get people wanting to use the space, you're not going to want people to come onto the program. You know, you've got to listen to everybody on your cohort, you know, listen to their experiences, their feedback. That's one thing that we do. So we're constantly evolving the program for them.
Amazing. And Joe, we kind of touched on this earlier, but what would you say are maybe the key rituals or tools from music production that other creative fields could benefit from?
So, yeah, I guess, probably a few things I've mentioned already, but it's, I think when you're collaborating in person, using a computer as a tool, I don't think is necessarily the best way. It ends up very shut off from other people in groups. So using tactile things, piece of paper, kind of, you know, something other than like a screen that only one of you can view, I think is really good. Again, things like, you know, oblique strategies, etching, lateral thinking tools when you're hitting roadblocks. Also, I guess, so much of what we do as producers in the studio is learning how to communicate individually with the specific artist or person you're working with. And sometimes I find, because, you know, I don't work in a kind of corporate environment, that coming into different spaces that I, even the language, I find quite foreign. And that can kind of, it's kind of sometimes feels quite othering, you know, in a way. Whereas like a lot of what we do is trying to make sure that communication is like coming from the person that we're working with, and so making sure that we're communicating in a way that works for them, rather than kind of expecting people to come into an environment and communicate the way that we do.
Taught their language.
Mm.
Yeah, amazing. Mm. So Grace, I know we've touched on this before around you kind of shaping the design of the Campfield campus. I mean, these buildings are iconic in the city, Grade 2 listed market hall buildings, which you've kind of reimagined, reinvented. Can you tell us about some of the challenges to working with a historic building, and especially kind of redesigning it and reimagining it this way for future facing work? It's kind of quite the opposite of what it was originally designed for in some ways. How was that process?
So the tricky thing about these buildings definitely is sort of the limitations on changing how they look outwardly. And that is really hard when you're trying to reposition, reframe, give it a new use and attract lots of new people in. It's everything from signage to door openings, the amount we can open the facade, all of that is really heavily controlled. And although the buildings have been redecorated, they don't look massively different in design than what they did 2 years ago. However, we should see this also as sort of a benefit as well, because it does give an opportunity to create this real sense of juxtaposition and sort of a joy in the surprise when you walk in. It is a totally contrasting space than what you might imagine it looks like on the outside. So that is quite exciting, sort of the play and the tension between the two. The listed buildings also sort of down to the detail, there's a bit more thought that goes into the materiality and what was here to start with. So I'll just try and describe this with words, as I know podcast, I won't point too much, but for example, all of the sort of timber cladding that surrounds the ground floor suites, this was all historically timber floorboards that was off of very small mezzanines. So it really makes you think twice about actually taking anything out. It's like, can we reuse that? Whereas on another building, it is way cheaper and easier to just strip it out and start again, and how do we want to decorate it? But actually, we've been forced, our hand is sort of more forced to try and do that, which is a great lesson for all of us. There's another example, which is actually the new reception desk. When you enter off Lower Byrom Street, you never would guess it. It looks like a beautiful, shiny new green profiled reception desk. But all of those sort of tiny timber planks are actually previously balusters that came off the edge of the mezzanine, which have been repurposed. So there's some really nice stories within this building from the historic fabric.
Amazing. It looks incredible, Grace. And all the design, I know, I think everyone will agree, it's like really kind of integrated and it feels really well fitting to the like historic integrity of the building. So you've done an amazing job of retaining that fabric. It really does. It is amazing. So Rich, then back on kind of like accelerators, I mean, what lessons would you say? Because I know like Exchange is predominantly a tech accelerator. Now we're kind of leaning more in towards a kind of digital and creative industry kind of focus. But what would lessons from a tech-focused accelerator could apply to artists, would you say, or social ventures?
That's actually a really good question. I think in terms of, so our early stage program, although we focus on the basics as being a tech-enabled or digital-enabled business, the subjects or the workshops that we put on can be applied to any sector. So, you know, we look at tech, operations, marketing, finance and legal, but that can be applied to any business, right? It doesn't, you don't have to join Exchange. I could, you know, go out to anyone that's got that idea or that early stage business and talk to them around that. I think definitely, you know, having accelerators that are, or incubators that are sector specific, like I mentioned earlier, definitely helps with attracting that tribe. So having a program or a space where people within that same sector can collaborate, that's going to help them massively. You know, there's nothing worse than going into another space where you've got multi different sectors and you don't really have anything in common with those people. Already, if you're within that same sector or same space, you instantly know, okay, yeah, they're pretty much on the same page as I am. So I think having these creative spaces, especially like Campfield, you know, everyone that's going to be within this space is pretty much in the same sector. So those water cooler moments will probably be a lot easier than if you're in a multi-sector space.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because even though the concepts, the businesses aren't generic, a lot of the barriers to growth are quite generic and everyone kind of faces the same issues.
Do you know what? You wake up with your idea. There's no handbook. There's no guidebook. You kind of got to, I might swear now, you kind of got to make this shit up as you go along, right? You really do, right? And there's no right or way to do it. And I think I'd be a millionaire now by the amount of times that I always say this. But if it was that easy being a founder, we'd all be doing it. And it's, I always say it's hats off, like admiration to absolutely the founders in the room. It's honestly, it's absolutely blood, sweat and tears. You know, you're probably wearing 100 hats every other day. You know, you're putting out, I don't know how many fires a day. You're not just doing one job role. So like massive admiration to any founders that are listening or, you know, that are in the room. It's, yeah, I couldn't do it.
Absolutely not.
I was just going to say from an accelerator perspective as well, I think completely agree with Rich that having spaces and programs that are sector specific definitely helps when you've got that kind of peer-to-peer moment. And we know that continues beyond the accelerator. I think the other thing that it's our job to do as people who run these programs is make sure that we're providing all of our participants with a line of sight from a success perspective that they wouldn't have on their own. So it is no surprise to anyone that as a tech ecosystem, we are historically underinvested in. You know, we know that the vast majority of tech investment from a VC point of view goes to London and the Southeast, and it has done since the dawn of time. What that means is that from a kind of generations of founder perspective, we are not awash with founders that have built unicorns and can be found easily. And everyone has got, you know, they're two people away from someone who's built a really globally significant business. In those instances, it's our jobs as the people who run programs to provide access to people that have built big global success stories, that know what the journey looks like that you're about to go on. And I think that you just can't get outside of a really well thought through accelerator program. If you're in a city like this, as bustling and as thriving as we are, you still need someone to help show you, you know, you might be kind of confident now in steps 1 to 5, but what are steps like 10 to 100? So, yeah.
It's like, takes us into this question quite nicely and neatly. So I know that Rich touched on before Greater Manchester kind of emerging recently as one of the UK's leading hubs from a tech and innovation perspective, especially in AI, probably thanks to a lot of the work that you've done, Liz. And I know you kind of touched on a barrier there with regards to investment. And as we know, things being quite kind of like London-centric. I mean, it has been forever and it probably will continue to be for a very long time. We've got an extremely long way to go, as everyone knows. But what do you think makes this region in particular so well suited to creative and technological growth?
I think there's a ballsiness about the
Mancunians.
This is going to sound really nerdy, but bear with me because it does play out. We were talking just before we came up here about the fact that despite the fact I am quite old at this point and I've lived in this city my entire life, I never really knew the story of the ship canal. Like, I knew it was a ship canal and it used to have big ships on it, but I didn't really know the history of it. And then I was flicking through the channels not long ago and there was a whole documentary on it. Bear with me. Honestly, bear with me. And the thought that at 35 miles from the sea, as a city, we would decide, Liverpool, I see you with your port, but we're going to build our own. And don't worry, we're just going to build this whole ship canal that bypasses you. I found hilarious and super interesting, but we were talking about the fact that it's such a Manchester thing to do. Like, we've got no right to have a port and build an entire like industrial revolution off the back of it. From a tech point of view, we did the same thing with cyber about 7 or 8 years ago. Howard Bernstein, Richard Leese and co went down to GCHQ in Cheltenham and said, you're looking for a location for GCHQ outside of Cheltenham. It should be in Manchester, and these are all the reasons why. If you speak to anyone that was involved in that, they will admit that they were shaky reasons at best. Like, we didn't really have a claim on that. And we are now such a significant cyber and cybersecurity sector. We've got entire spaces and assets that are built around it. So there's something for me about, yes, we're historically underinvested in, but we don't worry about that because London's only 2 hours on the train anyway. But there's just a bravery about, okay, I see all of your challenges, but I'm going to build it anyway. And I think that's pretty special.
First computer, first commercial railway in the world. We deserve to be audacious as Manx, don't we?
We actually do.
And an inland port, stop it all. Bizarre.
You didn't think you were going to hear about any land port today, did you?
History lesson with Liz.
To be fair, though, we've got little. I shouldn't point, should I, because of the podcast?
No, you can.
But there are little ships. As
part, like, the Manchester Shield.
Very cool.
She's there.
Very
the
cool. She's
we'll
everywhere.
I'll get it in post-production. So now this is like a bit of an overall panel question. So just jump in if the mood takes you. But we've kind of talked about spaces, systems, sound, and technology. In your view, what's the one conditional, be that physical, emotional, social, or structural, that consistently helps creativity thrive?
I think it is creating, if a space looks great, it will be occupied, and it is actually having the people around. It's the community. That's what makes people want to come and work somewhere. It's the reason why you don't sit at home. You go and do work in a coffee shop, because it is really easy to zone in when you see other people zoning in around you.
And like post-pandemic, not to talk about the pandemic, because that doesn't feel like it ever happened now, but it did. More than ever, you kind of crave being around people, don't you? You need social equity, and like you kind of realize the value of that more than ever. I found so anyway. Mm. It was like a really odd time that kind of started as a novelty, and then now I think it's accelerated people wanting to be back in the physical space together. So even though at one point it was like real estate's dead, and we were developing a whole city center,
whole district.
Oh, it's a shaky moment.
It was a real surprise when everyone came back, though, and it was up.
They came back. And like, here we are now launching this incredible new kind of 130,000 square foot campus, and it's full today. And
this is why, isn't it? Like, why would you be in your sad spare bedroom when you could come and hang out here? And also have those moments that, you know, having we were joking about the fact that you and I walked around Bonded in hard hats for a long time before it was ready and before we could launch Exchange. But having seen how that's come to life, and how having seen how Rich and you and the team can engineer those moments so that the people that are based there can see a bit of what else is going on. Because I think the space is amazing, and having interest in businesses is amazing, but you do have to engineer those moments so people can see, oh, I see what you're building, and that's cool, and I would never have thought of that, and I wonder if there's an application for that in my business. And so going beyond just the space, I think those are the things that like spark the creativity.
It's intentional design, isn't it? Everything's intentional. Nothing's an accident.
It's those water cooler moments as well, right? Yeah.
Are there any water coolers in this building? I haven't seen
We've
any.
Got taps.
Taps.
Yeah.
Refreshment zones.
Sorry, my apologies. Refreshment
zones.
Get it
right. So this brings us to the final question. Looking ahead, what's one change you think we'll see or need to see in how we support creative work over the next 5 to 10 years?
I don't mind starting on this one. We've covered it off already. AI, it's the big thing at the moment, isn't it? The next 5 to 10 years, very, very interesting. I'm excited to see where it goes. Again, like getting back to what I was saying earlier, I think it's definitely a mindset thing. People just need to get over the whole, it's going to steal my job. If you look at it as a productivity thing, but if we create in those spaces where we can help AI thrive as well, you've got the Great Tick program. You know, do we need to build something that helps those later stage businesses potentially in the next 5 years or so, maybe even sooner?
We're on it.
Okay. Heard it here first. They're on it. I think that's definitely one of the things that I'm looking forward to, especially for Manchester anyway, the next 5 years, just to see how AI explodes. And with Manchester being a city full of pioneers and innovators, us being at the forefront of that.
Just to build on that, I was just going to say, I think we've got the stars are lining up to make this a really interesting moment. So economically, the world's in a crazy place, isn't it? Like, you never know what you're going to wake up to. However, we've been here before. We've lived through this tumult before. If I look at the last 15 years or so that I've spent looking after startups, so that, this job is very Manchester focused, but the previous role, I was responsible for the entirety of the UK. So I used to get to kind of hang out in a nosy in all the tech ecosystems kind of up and down the country. The biggest kind of peak in innovation and startup births was immediately following financial crisis of 2008, because all of a sudden a bunch of really smart people had been made redundant from jobs. And if you've not got a salaried job to go to, maybe you'll start that thing that you've always been thinking about. And actually with AI, it's much quicker to just try it and spin something up and get it out in the market and see if there's a response. So I think, you know, as well as the sort of established and more intentional and planned startups and scale-ups that we've already got, we're also just going to see a load of experimentation, and some of those are going to be stellar when they grow.
So exciting.
Tan, do you remember that time we like did an app in like 5 minutes using ChatGPT?
Yeah, but now since I found out it hallucinates, I'm not so confident about that app actually. Well, thank you so much to our incredible panelists today. This is actually, we just christened Campfield with the first panel discussion, one of probably, hopefully, many. And thank you so much, guys, for kind of listening to us. You've been listening to Foundations, a celebration of bold beginnings, brave ideas, and the people who make them possible. If you like what you've heard, please remember to subscribe to Foundations wherever you get your podcasts, and follow at Campfield MCR on both Instagram and LinkedIn for more information on future episodes and all the great events we have happening here at Campfield. See you soon. You've been listening to Foundations, a celebration of bold beginnings, brave ideas, and the people who make them possible. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts for the latest episodes, and follow at Campfield MCR on Instagram.